You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 7th of April 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist in association with UBS. Live from Zurich, this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up:
during the course of this afternoon, the Prime Minister's condition worsened, and on the advice of the medical team, he was moved in to a critical care unit. So in light of those circumstances, the Prime Minister asked me as First Secretary to deputise for him where necessary in driving forward the government's plans to defeat coronavirus.
The UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson is admitted to intensive care as his coronavirus symptoms worsen. We'll have the latest. Then Germany's Angela Merkel says this is the European Union's make or break moment. We'll unpack her leadership as she returns to work following a stint in quarantine. Also ahead, Japan looks set to declare a state of emergency. And we ask, what are the security implications for a Europe under lockdown? Plus the latest newspapers here on the continent and why Denmark is easing restrictions. All that and more ahead on The Globalist, live from Zurich. Well, good morning from a very crispy, sunny Zurich. You're with me, Tyler Brulé, here on The Globalist. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. China has reported no new coronavirus deaths today. It's the first time since Beijing started publishing figures in January. Meanwhile, France recorded yesterday its highest daily death toll with 833 coronavirus fatalities in 24 hours. And in New Zealand, the health minister there, David Clark, has been demoted after he ignored national lockdown rules and drove his family to his batch 20 kilometres from his home. Well, you can stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, the news dominating headlines across the globe right now is that the UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been moved into intensive care in St. Thomas's Hospital, London, after his coronavirus symptoms deteriorated. Well, for more on that, I'm joined by our editor, Andrew Tuck, also our frontman for the foreign desk, Andrew Muller. Andrew Tuck, good morning. Maybe just bring us up to speed as to what's been happening overnight.
Hello. So it's been alarming news overnight. Not much has come out this morning, but all of the papers are saying that it would be likely that he has been moved into intensive care because he does have probably pneumonia at this point and will be assisted with his breathing, but may also be gaining other medical help to assist his key organs functioning as well. So he's in a very small minority. About 5% of people who catch COVID-19 end up in the situation that he's in. But to be clear, it's a very dangerous situation where many people, unfortunately, do not come out of hospital. And also those who go into hospital do not leave within a few days. Many of the people who have been admitted here into hospital in the UK, in fact, the vast majority who have been admitted to intensive care are still there after days. So we're not expecting him to suddenly reappear, you know, on the steps of Downing Street in the coming days. This is him out of action for a long time.
Andrew, does it strike you that there's two stories here? We were talking late in the evening yesterday. Of course, there is the Prime Minister in intensive care. Sky News is reporting this morning that he's been struggling to breathe. I know what that means. I guess we'll have to find out a little bit later. But the second story here is also just the handling of all of this by Downing Street. On one side, they seem to feel that they're very much across the story, but all eyebrows were raised during a press conference yesterday when we heard that the now appointed Deputy Prime Minister, Dominic Raab, hadn't spoken to the Prime Minister for some 2 days.
Well, the press corps here, you know, feeds off the Downing Street machine, and they are very much wrapped into it at the moment as part of this kind of this national campaign to keep Britain staying at home, to get people following the advice. So I think that many of them feel a little bit conflicted, probably. They probably feel that they're on the side almost of Downing Street. You know, they're at the daily briefings, well, via television link. That they're kind of almost on it, part of the machine at this moment. Now, suddenly this morning, you read stories where people are saying, well, actually, we heard as long ago as last Thursday that potentially a hospital bed had been reserved for Boris Johnson at St. Thomas's Hospital, where he currently is. And that actually later in the week, people were saying he's properly sick. And then the other clue is Donald Trump saying that he was praying for Boris Johnson well before he was admitted into intensive care, that through back channels, the US had been told that the British Prime Minister was getting very ill. So it's strange that more questions weren't raised earlier and none of these rumours were even speculated upon. And as you say, you get the feeling that everybody is towing the line at this point in a national crisis.
Andrew Miller, good morning to you. It was interesting watching the coverage last night because, as Andrew was saying, you have these key voices, faces that we're familiar with, the Beth Rigby's from Sky, the Laura Kunzbergs from the BBC, who you think are asking the type of questions. And then in this moment, they weren't really there. Then I flipped over to CNN. I saw their Clarissa Ward asking those questions that you would think the British press would be asking. And it was just interesting to sort of see it through the prism of an international network on the doorstep of St. Thomas's as well. How have you observed this over the last, well, certainly 18 hours since this has broken?
It's much as Andrew Tuck was just saying, I think there is a certain amount of bafflement verging on panic as to how people are supposed to respond in a situation like this, not just the wider story of the pandemic, but the fact of what is clearly a serious illness to the Prime Minister. Britain, of course, does not have a written down constitution. There is no formal order of succession as there is in the United States, where if something happens to the president, it's the vice president and then the Speaker of the House and then so on. As Andrew was also saying, Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary and First Secretary of State, has been kind of designated successor, at least temporary, while Boris Johnson is incapacitated. But there are extreme questions about what the limits of his powers and prerogatives actually are. This is presumably up to the Queen, ultimately, and she is obviously another hint. As Andrew was also saying, there's been rumours about Boris Johnson's actual health flying around for days, and I don't think it's coincidental that the Queen was activated to speak to the nation on Sunday night. That's only the fourth time in her entire reign that she has made an unscheduled broadcast to the nation. So I think there's been a fairly hasty attempt to erect some kind of carapace of reassurance over the last few days.
Andrew Miller, did Dominic Raab, did he inspire some level of confidence? Looking at it from here, it seemed like the understudy going into the Christmas play suddenly called upon because the leading man wasn't going to make it to stage. I thought it was a little bit chilling to watch.
I think it was a genuinely human moment, to be honest. I think Raab appeared absolutely bewildered and terrified, which I appreciate is not the image you want to project at a moment of national crisis, but it is entirely understandable. I mean, the personal dynamics of this very strange government come into play at that point as well. This was very much a government elected with a thumping majority in December, but very much ran and won as the Boris Johnson show. And I think we're learning that they don't bat very far down the order.
Andrew Tuck, when you look at this, and are we surprised already? It's just after 7 a.m. in London. Would you have thought that Downing Street at this point would have, and that the comms department at Downing Street would have received a message that people want to be kept up to speed here, that there is going to be an announcement at 9 o'clock or that there will be a press conference at noon, but nothing so far, it seems.
No, so there are two things at play. One, obviously, is the deterioration of his health and what's happened overnight. There will have been very, very key hours between that admission yesterday evening and this morning, when lots of the parameters for how bad this is going to get will have become clear to his doctors. So I would imagine this morning that there will be a briefing to Downing Street by the medical team, but more importantly to Carrie Symons, his partner, who's pregnant, who also has symptoms of coronaviruses and is not with him. So I think as in most human situations, they will go through speaking to the family first and then speaking to Downing Street. But the government will have to tell people what's going on because, as you say, it's critical time for dealing with COVID-19 here in the UK. Incredible decisions need to be made. We're on the back foot with testing. We're watching as other European countries get their act together and begin to pull out of this crisis. But here in the UK, we seem to be still stymied. The numbers never seem to make much sense. So it's a very concerning point. Now, while everyone may know what their job is in government, a figure like Boris Johnson, for good or bad, was able to whip all those people into line. And that's the concern this morning. One, we won't know what's happening to him. But two, more importantly, we won't know what's going to be happening to the country over the next day or two.
Andrew Mueller, just before we go, do you think that there has to be almost another approach right now? Because everyone says that you probably have that the top leadership are at each other's throats. Now, that may or may not be true. But of course, we know there's some very, very big egos at play. Could we end up looking at some type of stewardship, which is really calling someone in almost out of retirement, in the same way that we've seen, you know, police and NHS workers called in off the very back benches? Might we have to look for another type of leadership right now, or are we going to go with what we've got?
I think it's likely that they will try to go with what they've got, but I think what we will start to hear more of in the next few days, certainly if it turns out that Boris Johnson is extremely sick. And as Andrew Tuck was saying earlier, in the best case scenario, he will be out of action for some time. I think we might start to hear more clamour for or more discussion of some kind of government of national unity, which is more possible this week than it was last week. The opposition Labour Party now has a new leader in place, Sir Keir Starmer. He is a serious and capable individual. He has named a shadow cabinet, which does seem largely comprised of serious and capable individuals. It would be a very, very tough thing for the Conservative Party to accommodate and to swallow. British politics is extremely tribal, but I think this is going to be a question that gets asked a lot in the next few days and weeks.
Andrew Mueller from our foreign desk, Andrew Tuck, our editor, thanks very much both for joining us. You are listening to The Globalist. This is Monocle 24. And you're back with The Globalist here in Zurich with me, Tyler Berlay. So just gone 15:13 in Tokyo. Now it's 13:14 if you're listening in Bangkok. Well, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has returned to office after being under quarantine for 2 weeks. And in a press conference yesterday, she stressed how this is the European Union's biggest challenge since its foundation and how, more than ever, there needs to be unity and solidarity across the bloc. Well, for more on this and Germany's response to the pandemic, I'm joined by Anna Rosenberg, who's the head of Europe and the UK at political consultancy Signum Global. And she's joining me this morning from Freudenstadt in Germany. Guten Morgen.
Guten Morgen. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Let's start, because a little bit later in the program, we're going to be having a piece from our foreign editor about what's happening to the borders in the east, in Austria, some of the moves that were made by Chancellor Kurz yesterday. Last night, we also saw similar moves in terms of an easing also made by Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen. And maybe to start, is this sort of it's a small pincer movement. There's smaller countries, Denmark and Austria, certainly not Germany. But is there suddenly pressure in Berlin this morning to maybe advance all of this? Because, of course, we've seen Chancellor Merkel saying, you know, we have to wait step by step here, people. But I'm wondering if there is some type of pressure now.
I think that that pressure is mainly, of course, it is there. It is political. It has been there for a while. People want to go back to normality. But quite frankly, I think it's fictional. I think people are in a way not being honest with us in the sense that we're not going to return to normality anytime soon. Even if there are some easing of restrictions, we're heading to a new normal that will look very different to what we were used to before the crisis. So yes, there may be some pressure building in Germany, and you've seen some opposition voices claiming that the lockdown measures are very bad for the economy. I guess they will be getting louder, as they're doing in all countries. But I think it's too early yet. Well, I think it's more realistic to think about some easing towards May. But when I'm talking about easing, I think we're going towards a new normal where people will still keep quite a bit of a distance and economic activity will still be subdued.
It's maybe not the time, but of course, everyone is doing it. There's certainly a lot of scorecards being flashed up for leadership all over the world, and particularly in Europe. Of course, Frau Merkel has come out of quarantine or self-isolation, and she's back on the stage. How would you say that certainly the German population, also the German media, what is the tone in Germany right now in terms of both her leadership stance, but also just how she's running this crisis so far?
So this is really interesting. I mean, there were a lot of criticism about Merkel and the ruling coalition just before the COVID crisis hit. Many commentators expected it would fall at any moment and early elections would be possible. That's completely forgotten now. And by the way, not just in Germany, but across many European countries that had unstable political coalitions like Italy and Spain. In a way, a health crisis really helps the incumbent. It makes them stronger because people want strong leadership. And Merkel is benefiting from this a lot. Actually, in the early days of the pandemic, she did not do particularly well. She kept very quiet and was too slow to react. But then over the time, she came out and with her calm messages, scientific background and rational decision making, she won over the population again. And people feel confident to have such a strong leader. But I would not draw conclusions about what that means for her at the next election in 2021. I think there is a moment of time when incumbents will see an increase in opposition again. And I expect that will happen in the next month because people will be fed up with the lockdown measures. And that will also happen in Germany. So I think that in Germany, it's still uncertain if we're going to see a German chancellor from the CDU or from potentially the Green Party next year.
Tell me, in terms of Germany's position and profile elsewhere in Europe, of course, we have seen southern states saying that perhaps they've not been treated fairly, and not just by Germany, but of course by people on the other side, or nations on the other side of the Alps. But at the same time, Germany's been doing some very high profile, you call them medical missions, in a way. You've seen the aircraft of the Luftwaffe flying in, very high-tech aircraft, which in one way it's a form of soft power for Germany, and bringing patients from Italy, of course, into Cologne, into the Charité in Berlin. I mean, likewise, we've also seen, of course, patients coming from France, Alsace, also into Germany. How has that played at home? And do you think also there's been, and you know, has the rest of the world and certainly Europe also noticed the role that Germany has been playing in a very, yeah, I mean, you'd say in a very sleeves up manner at this time?
That's an interesting question. I would say that, of course, this is happening and it is being welcomed by southern states, but it's certainly not gaining a lot of attention compared to the divisions we're currently seeing on the European finance ministers level, where we're talking about how economic and financial support will look like across the Eurozone. That's a much more contentious issue. There's a lot of debate right now over Germany and other northern states basically funding the debt of southern European states. And that is hugely divisive. And that is certainly currently gaining center ground. And so people are not necessarily looking very much at those soft power interventions that you just mentioned. Of course, they are welcome. But actually, when you hear the voices coming out of Italy and from Spain, there's a lot of noise about the help that these states are getting from China, for example, in order to step up pressure towards the EU to basically react much more aggressively with common fiscal help, which is arguably even more needed than support when it comes to the healthcare situation at the moment.
And it's interesting because Frau Merkel has also been talking about some lessons learned, some live lessons as we go through this, something as simple as masks, and maybe using them somewhat symbolically, Anna, as well, that you know, we need to be also looking at our supply chain. We need to be looking at where we're manufacturing things. Perhaps the reliance on China that we have is not great, which brings us to, of course, the broader question of the EU. There's, of course, and it's not just been the Chancellor, many other leaders as well, talking about a make or break moment for the EU. Is it that critical as we emerge from this? Does there have to be a massive reset, or could you argue that reset has to be happening as we speak right now?
I think it certainly is a make or break moment, but I am much more bullish about the outlook for the EU than others for a variety of reasons. So firstly, I do think it's a matter of really days now that the EU will come together with a big joint fiscal stimulus plan that everyone's looking for. And that once we enter in the recovery phase, that plan and that reaction will be even much, much bigger. And at that point in time, you will have no member states saying, oh, I don't want to be part of this. I'd rather walk away. So in the recovery phase, as these funds are allocated and the support is allocated, everyone wants to be part of the EU. The EU is currently realizing that the reason it cannot act better is because it actually does not have that much joint power. a lot of the power still resides with the member states when it comes to healthcare, for example. So I think that the opposite will happen, and that's what always happens when the EU goes through crisis, which is that the EU realizes it needs more joint power. And in a way, I think we're going to leave this crisis with the EU in a stronger position, with more joint funds, more joint healthcare capabilities, and more emergency response capabilities. And ironically, I think another thing we're going to witness as part of this is a strengthening of the center-left, because where I know there are a lot of fears about right and left-wing populism taking advantage of this situation. But the reality is that what we're seeing is a strengthening of the welfare state right now, even in conservative, economically conservative governments. And I think the opposite will happen. You're going to see a strengthening of the center-left school of thought that is obviously also very supportive of the EU.
Anna Rosenberg, head of Europe and UK at the political consultancy Signum. Thanks very much for joining us from Freudenstadt in Germany this morning. Still to come on the program, Monocle's Chris Chermak looks to Austria and its Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz.
Kurz's speech felt like a masterclass in managing behavior. It involved a carrot and stick approach that includes a time horizon for how and when this will end.
This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. More after this.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You're back with The Globalist here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. I'm now joined by Benno Zog. It's almost a new title for you. We're calling you, Benno, our Monocle 24 security correspondent. How's that as a way to start your Tuesday morning? Listen, there's a variety of things that we've been witnessing that are happening beyond this story. Stories that actually, from a defense and security point of view, would have made much bigger headlines. A couple of weeks ago, we see a flotilla of Russian ships perhaps getting too close to British territorial waters. We've seen scramble of aircraft in North America, and this is of course both Canadian and U.S. fighter aircraft scrambling because again Russian aircraft are getting too close. Within Switzerland, I was driving the other day, and just you realize the military mobilization that is going on. So I guess to start, is there a tension, I think, when you look at security forces across the continent right now being overstretched? In France, we had an attack at the weekend near Grenoble, where of course now looks like it's a terrorist investigation as well. I don't want to say eyes are off the ball, but this is a lot for, of course, ministries to be dealing with right now.
Good morning, Tyler. I think that this is very true, and we've seen that in other crises as well, for example, during terrorist threats that the army was very much used. And this emphasizes this point that the military or the army in all kinds of countries is kind of a strategic reserve for states to fall back on in case civilian administration and police and civil protection are overstretched. And during a pandemic like this, this is exactly the case. So, for example, in Switzerland, we see the militia army as a strategic reserve that is very much used right now. But apart from being used to fight a pandemic in whatever way, for logistics, for example, like airlift, is super important these days, and we've seen that in a number of European countries, the military or armies are affected themselves as well, because sailors, soldiers, generals can be infected with coronavirus. And we've seen that, for example, in the US, quite strikingly, where the aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt had about 200 corona cases on board, and it had to reduce its activities. If we're talking about just one aircraft carrier, this will obviously not tip the strategic balance in any kind of theater in a very meaningful way. But some commentators already hinted that. For example, in the South China Sea, where the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese Navy, says that they're not affected by corona, whereas some of the American ships are, will this make them bolder to move ahead? And there's this corroding, creeping escalation there, that there's tiny steps of creating airfields, of maneuvers, of patrols. Will this embolden them to make another move like this in such times?
Yesterday, we saw in the UK, and certainly a story that's in many ways has been overshadowed, of course, by the events with the Prime Minister, that we had the Commons Foreign Affairs Committee, I mean, really calling China's response and really China's opaque nature in terms of releasing information about, of course, this virus into question. I mean, and we saw an interview with the one of the ministers from the Chinese embassy in the UK, really locking horns with a journalist about this very, very defensive. And it was curious to watch because obviously, you know, much of what this foreign affairs this Commons paper is saying is that, you know, you could argue that China was trying to score strategic points. They were holding this back. Now, you could have said it was strategic points from a domestic perspective, but obviously, of course, it has international ramifications. In your world of looking at strategic studies and other elements, do you think there's a component of that, that maybe China thought, okay, there is a way of getting a leg up through this and also through the management of information or lack of dissemination of information?
To be honest, I think this is giving China too much credit and too much control about this situation. I think Chinese political system has some inherent flaws, as we saw, particularly that it does cover up things. There is censorship. There is a political elite that is afraid of any kind of popular dissent, that is used to having this enormous power, and then a pandemic or the rumor of a pandemic and the appearance of being weak will come in very damaging. So I rather think that these structural factors actually played a role. But now, obviously, China's confronted with this situation. How do we turn the narrative? And I think there, an element of even warfare would be who controls the narrative and how can this weaken or embolden the enemy, if you will, not that there's antagonism between the UK or China or anything, in a way. So this is kind of a dimension of this now and of international relations. And China certainly does its best to also deflect from the fact that this is a virus that originated in China due to some structural factors there. And I hope there will be a lot of investigations as well into this, ideally by the WHO or by investigative journalists. What has gone wrong? What were the structural factors? Who is to blame? And not like China or the Chinese people to blame, but certain structural factors there. And then hopefully it will never take this dimension of actual confrontation or any country, for example, being tempted to escalate warlike in any scenario to kind of distract from what is going on right now and from the actual health issue that we have.
Just before we go, do you see this, because you talk about, you know, whether it's going to be, and we get to the root cause of something like this because of good investigative journalism, or it's the role of the WHO, or of course other medical authorities. But is there a component when we're talking about something which has been so crucial and the crisis the world has been thrown into, that does this also become militarized? And well, is there almost a new type of intelligence which doesn't sit with medical authorities anymore? It's certainly, of course, looking at viruses, but it's going to be sitting with the BND in Germany, or it's going to be sitting with MI6 and many other authorities at this point to keep an eye on whether it's China or whether something breaks out somewhere else. It's not just the role of someone who's the medical liaison at the embassy in Beijing anymore.
I do think there's certainly always been an element of that, because, I mean, in the end, there is such a thing as biological or chemical warfare, for example. And there have been viruses during the Cold War, for example, that were developed to hurt an enemy in some case. But there's international regulation against it. There's certain authorities who can check on that. And, for example, when it comes to chemical weapons, we've seen exactly that in Syria. What it particularly shows, though, is a thing that a load of institutions, whether that's states, militaries, or alliances like NATO, were not prepared for anything like that. We're not talking about a virus that was released willingly by anyone, but as a security threat. Because I think we have to rethink security in the first place, and that includes armies and alliances like NATO, that health of people is at stake, the functioning of armies and militaries are at stake, and all kinds of strategic documents have not really included this factor of a pandemic in any of their planning. And I think it now matters whether these structures can adapt to this new challenge, but also obviously that they can investigate and make sure they're prepared in all kinds of ways, not just to respond to such another crisis, because there will be a next pandemic, but also to prevent it in whatever way and have the intelligence means to do so.
Benno Zog, a security correspondent here in Zurich. Very, very good talking to you. You're listening to Monocle 24. We're back after this. And catching up with world headlines, China has reported no new coronavirus deaths today. It is the first time since Beijing started publishing figures in January. The country has shut its borders to foreigners, though most imported cases have involved Chinese nationals returning from overseas. Meanwhile, France recorded yesterday its highest daily death toll with 833 coronavirus fatalities in the last 24 hours. Italy's daily death toll also rose on Monday after several days of slowing, but Spain's fell for a fourth day. And New Zealand's health minister has been demoted after he ignored national lockdown rules and drove his family to a beach hut 20 kilometers from his home. David Clark admitted the drive was a clear breach of the lockdown principle. Seems to be a bit of a trend with people in chief medical or health officer roles. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. And you're back with The Globalist here on Monocle 24, just 8:32 here in Zurich. It's 15:32 in Tokyo, where we head to speak to our bureau chief there, Fiona Wilson. Good afternoon, Fiona.
Good afternoon.
Well, it seems like we've been asking the same question now for about 4 days, but I'm going to ask it one more time. It's the longest lead up to the announcement of emergency measures I think I've seen in any G7 country ever. We are told tonight that Prime Minister Abe is going to, of course, announce, obviously, a state of emergency for Japan. Is it going to happen?
I know it's been quite a waiting game, hasn't it? I mean, where we are today, this afternoon, government ministers have been hearing from the panel of experts explaining why the state of emergency is necessary. This is all part of the legal process. They have to do this before they can green light state of emergency. Shinzo Abe, the prime minister, will be listening to questions from the upper and lower houses and apparently will be declaring officially the state of emergency tonight. I mean, I assume that will happen. It's really been outlined in fairly, you know, quite some detail, the locations, roughly the length. I mean, what it means in Japan, a state of emergency, it means that the government gives the power to the governors of these seven prefectures. That gives them the authority then to make their own decisions about how they will handle it. They'll be given a certain amount of powers and they can, you know, there's a certain amount of discretion, it has to be said. I mean, we've been most interested to listen to Governor Koike in Tokyo. She's been saying very sort of loudly, you know, absolutely, we want this to be over as quickly as possible. And obviously, it's such a huge hit to the Japanese economy if Tokyo shuts down. They don't want it to happen for very long. So she's been saying, as long as people behave, you know, follow the rules, behave correctly, this will be over. You know, she didn't say quickly, but she said she'd like it to be done quickly. And, you know, it seems that it's still this issue that we keep coming back to, which is a state of emergency in Japan is not enforceable. So it's about requesting people to stay at home, requesting businesses to close, urging. These are the kind of words they're using. And of course, there are certain things that can also happen. Schools can be closed. They have been closed already. You know, medicines can be expropriated. So, you know, measures are being taken. It's not enforceable. But I think people are, as you say, it's been going on for quite a long time now. So people are very prepared for the fact that it's going to happen. How it will actually look is not very clear yet. And it may depend, you know, prefecture by prefecture. It might look a bit different in each place.
Well, I was wondering if you look up and down the Japanese archipelago, what's happening if we went out to Haneda with domestic flights right now? If we went down to Tokyo Main Station, are the Shinkansen sort of still running every 10 minutes? Or has there been a bit of a scale back, you know, even when you look at national logistics?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a huge scale back. You know, so there have been some really extraordinary pictures of Haneda, just the number of planes that are not taking off, lined up on the apron. I think ANA said that, you know, that they were down absolutely massively, 80% of their international flights. I think they said 30% of their domestic flights. had been cancelled. So, you know, you're really looking at monster cancellations. So, yeah, definitely people are still travelling. I think there's a feeling now that people from Tokyo particularly should not be sending themselves off to the country during any kind of state of emergency. They won't be welcome. And I think we've seen this happen in other countries already. And there's been a bit of noise on Twitter. Anyone who sort of starts talking about let's leave Tokyo has been roundly shouted at by people from places in the countryside. So I think people will be staying put. That's the idea anyway. But I think, yeah, definitely Haneda is an interesting case in point, because I think, you know, the airlines have been hit absolutely massively. And, you know, we saw ANA announcing huge furloughing of staff there. So, yeah, like everywhere else, it's hit those big the transport companies.
How much of all of this is being politicized or not as well? Because, you know, we've seen as countries have gone into lockdown, you know, it plays to, of course, you know, various parties as well. Oh, look at farm subsidies, subsidies for fisheries. You know, if we lock our borders, isn't it great that we've spent all of these years, you know, building up self-sufficiency? And in many ways, that is a big component of Japan. You know, there's a real pride, of course, in grown, fished, hunted in Japan. Does that start to play out right now a little bit? Are people trying to score points, saying, you know, maybe it's, you know, for all of the moaning and open markets before, it's wonderful that you can still get your pork chops from Yamagata, and you're going to have your lovely you know, peaches from Okayama.
I mean, it's interesting because Japan has such a toothless opposition. They're not putting up, you know, much of a fight to the government. There's been some noise about why it's taken so long to bring any kind of lockdown of any sort, really. I think what Shinzo Abe is doing, he is announcing the most sort of the biggest stimulus package ever seen in Japan. It's absolutely unprecedented. It's nearly $1 billion. It's 108 trillion yen. It's, you know, double what was offered in 2009, which I think is meant to, you know, keep people calm, reassure them. You know, they're going to be giving handouts to people, cash handouts, supporting small and mid-sized businesses. Tax payments are going to be, you know, be a period of grace for them, and social security payments. So I think they're really muffling potential opposition by setting up this huge stimulus package, and which will also, you know, once the virus has passed, which of course we hope it will eventually, that stimulus package will be targeting, you know, industries that are really suffering at the moment, you know, tourism, entertainment industry, and it says it's going to be boosting those sectors. So that's coming in the future. So I think Shinzo Abe is really, economy is always front and center for him, and that's true in this fight as well.
Fiona Wilson, our bureau chief in Tokyo. Very good to talk to you. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
You're back with The Globalist here on Monocle at 24 with me, Tyler Blaise. Just gone 8:40 in Zurich. It's also 8:40 in Copenhagen, where we're heading now, where the nation was one of the first European countries to impose a lockdown and effectively shut down the entire country. But now it seems that the Danes are ready to lift some of the restrictions to avoid a deep recession. Well, I'm joined on the line now by our correspondent there, Michael Booth, and also Martin Krasnick, who's the editor-in-chief of the Danish weekly broadsheet, Weekend Avisen. Hello, gentlemen.
Hi, Hello. Tyler.
Martin, let's start with you. Of course, we heard the Prime Minister Fredrickson, she was already making noise almost middle of last week, saying, I'm about to say something. Then there was, of course, an interview on DR, on your state broadcaster. And then there we saw it at 8 o'clock last night, this announcement of some elements of easing. Before we get there, was there a lot of pressure? Of course, we're not covering Copenhagen every second of the day, but I'm wondering what was happening across party lines in the background to... not force this so much, but was there pressure for her to get out in front in a way and be one of the first movers?
Both yes and no. I mean, you could say that relatively yes, because there was, for weeks almost no pressure, no opposition, and no real demands for an opening up. So in the last few days, there were tiny bits of voices, saying that now we really have to open up a bit, simply because the Danish numbers are so low now. You, of course, everywhere we have the green curve and the red curve, and Denmark was starting to fall below the green curve. So there were voices, not only from political sides, but from scientists and so on, academics, saying that we have to be careful now. You have to probably open up a bit for this to work out. I mean, there were criticisms saying that maybe Frederiksen, our prime ministers, were too successful in closing down everything. So that was, a bit of the pressure. And when the prime minister then spoke last night, you could hear the whole country. It's a small country, of course, but the whole country was quiet for those minutes where everybody was waiting for her to say which parts of the society she would open up. It's a really, really interesting situation where everybody collectively are looking at exactly the same at exactly the same time. And I think that there is now a bit of a disappointment that she didn't open up more, because there was this change of tone the last few days. And what she's doing now is that she's opening up schools, the small classes, the lower classes, up until fifth grade, and of course institutions for smaller children, and they are opening up. But that's it, really. That's it. And people were really hoping for more.
Michael, you've of course you've been chronicling the Danish story, and certainly not just the cultural story, not just the design story, but you've touched on from time to time on the topic of happiness, etc., and also the power of social capital. And I think for people who are looking at Denmark right now, of course, the medical services got some things right, and then people, of course, followed the rules. How important is social capital in all of this? Because I think, as we sort of, look at measures being lifted elsewhere in Europe, it seems that there is a bit of a divide between those countries where people can band together and follow guidelines. It's a little bit different than other nations.
Absolutely. I don't think it can be overstated, actually. The levels of interpersonal trust in Denmark are at the top of the world, but also the levels of trust in their institutions, and even, and this is quite hard to understand from a British and American perspective, but even in their politicians. And Mette Frederiksen, the Prime Minister, has only reinforced that with her performance over the past month. She's been really outstanding. And in a way, I was thinking about this, it goes back to the election which was held here last year. And it was an exemplary election held among grown-ups in a grown-up attitude of mutual respect. They dealt with the right-wing extremists very, very well. They moved on. It was extremely cordial and extremely professional, high turnout. And I think Mette Frederiksen is benefiting from that attitude that she demonstrated. She's the youngest prime minister in Denmark's history, but she's been absolutely incredible, and her approval ratings are up at 80% now. They've more than doubled during all of this. And Martin was right, the whole nation is sitting down to watch her press briefings, which she has led from the start, in contrast to Sweden, where Stefan Löfven, the prime minister there, has rather initially took a back seat to the scientific experts. This has very much been a politically led project in Denmark, and you're right, she has managed to bring together the nation. And it's because of that that the figures, as Martin says, are so relatively low. Still, though, she's putting the Danes on probation over Easter. this very small opening will happen after Easter, as long as everyone behaves themselves. And I think they will, actually. And then the next level will come on the 10th of May, when I think people are hoping that more shops might open and more services come back on stream. So it's a gradual reopening. Still, things like the Roskilde Festival will not happen. Major events through the summer have already been cancelled.
Martin, Michael brings up the topic of your neighbours across the Öresund, and was there also a sense watching the Swedish story play out? Because now I'm not sort of looking at Weekend Obviously every day, but certainly looking, let's say, what DR was reporting, for example, a little bit of astonishment, a little bit of amazement and wonder. And of course, you always have an interesting relationship with your neighbors up to the north. Did that also play into this as well? Were Danes looking at Sweden with sort of this sort of sense of wonder? How are they doing this? Was there sort of a sense of, look, at all of their stores are open, we're locked down here? Or was it more, actually, we're better, we're happier, actually, on this side of the sound?
These are our, you know, neighbors and brothers, but we are very, very far apart when it comes to politics and political culture. And this is obvious here, definitely obvious here. What as Michael's saying, is the difference is that in Denmark we have a very strong political leadership, a very visible political leadership here, with a very, very clear and one-sided message. I mean, there is really no cracks in the facade here. The message is clear. It's the same four persons every time. The prime minister, the health minister, the director of the health authorities, and then the police, the chief of police. And these four people, every time there is this unison message, those are the people who are talking. It's quite amazing. And it means that there's almost no place for the opposition to enter. I mean, there is no real room for opposition measures to get in. But what we're seeing right now is that I think that we will now see a repolitization of this whole discussion, where the opposition simply will have to try to bring in some kind of contradicting message. What they're doing now this morning is that they're saying that Frederick, prime minister, is simply too close. I mean, there was a real negotiation leading up to this this gradual opening, just like there were no real real political debate in parliament about this the last few weeks. Now they're of course claiming that we really need to have parliament to enter this this whole discussion. Otherwise, where's the democratic debate? And this will start now, definitely, because what Mette Frederiksen is almost a rock here. So the opposition will start to try to have their voice heard. And this is very interesting how they'll do that.
Martin Krasnick from the Danish weekly newspaper Weekend Avisen, and also our Michael Booth in Copenhagen. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us. Well, to the other side of Europe, and also a little bit of a story of an opening as well, Austria and Sebastian Kurz's decisive leadership. It seems that he's really sort of laid out a bit of a step-by-step plan to begin reopening shops in the nation. That was announced yesterday. Well, for more on that, here's Monocle's affairs editor Chris Chermak with the story.
At the start of this year, on the eve of Sebastian Kurz being inaugurated once again as Austrian Chancellor, I wrote a column musing about where I went wrong in failing to become a world leader in my 30s, and I wondered whether my fellow 30-somethings were really capable of governing responsibly. That question seemed even more relevant just 2 months later, as national leaders the world over were thrust into managing the worst crisis in most young people's lifetimes. So what's the verdict? Well, if Kurz is anything to go by, us 30-somethings can be pretty impressive when we want to be. Austria has acted resolutely in curbing the coronavirus spread, allowing Kurz yesterday to lay out a step-by-step plan for reopening business. That plan included opening small shops from April 14th, larger ones from May, restaurants in mid-May, and larger events not before the end of June. all of this should be done wearing masks required for all outdoor visits. Not only is this plan more detailed than most European countries have been able to present, but Kurz's timing was clever since it came with a caveat. If Austrians fail to stay home over the crucial Easter weekend coming up and the virus spreads further, he said that these easing measures won't be implemented. Right now, it's the uncertainty that can make all of this feel so unmanageable. I'm sure I'm not the only one who has had forlorn discussions along the lines of, when will all of this be over, or will we have to do this for a whole year? Given those discussions, Kurz's speech felt like a masterclass in managing behavior. It involved a carrot-and-stick approach that includes a time horizon for how and when this will end, coupled with exactly what needs to be done for that timeline to be kept. If you want to keep people in their homes, it helps to light a clear path to better days ahead.
Monocle's Affairs Editor Chris Chermak there. For more like that, plus the day's top stories delivered directly to your inbox at 7 a.m. local time, subscribe to Monocle Minute, and that's at monocle.com/minute. You're listening to The Globalist. Just 8:52 in Zurich, just enough time, about 7 minutes, to whip through the newspapers. He's got five stories lined up. Jan de Hinton, Bloomberg's bureau chief here in Zurich, is at the ready. I see that you're poised with highlighter in hand. And the NZZ, what are they saying this morning?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Indeed, yes. There's an interesting one in the NZZ, the Swiss newspaper of record, if you want. A guest piece by Mark Schelker, who's an economics professor at the University of Freiburg here in Switzerland. And it is about the question, human lives versus the economy, which is, the ethical conundrum of this day. He basically says that the idea of, us humans on this side against the economy on the other side is a question that doesn't exist because, of course, the economy, that's all of it. That's all of us, and expresses the expresses our human efforts. So he's basically saying this idea that you say, look, we can't ease any lockdown unless everyone's healthy is kind of the wrong way of looking at it, and that an extended lockdown isn't manageable without doing irreparable damage to the economy.
I'm looking over at your screen over there. Surprisingly, it's open to Bloomberg. Remarkably, you have a story there. It's a very tantalizing headline, Jan. And it's funnily enough, it's one I was thinking about as well. But what's the story you guys are carrying?
Yeah, I'm very happy with that headline. It's a story by our Geneva-based colleague Andy Hoffman, who normally covers commodities and oil and things like that. And he's written a very, very interesting piece about the Swiss stockpile of alcohol. Now, for those who don't know it, the Swiss have stockpiles of all sorts of things. So there's, cooking oil and flour and coffee even. That was
controversial a few months ago.
That was controversial a few months ago, but it's been reinstated. Surprisingly enough, they also had a stockpile of ethanol or alcohol, as it's known to the rest of us, and to be used in case of, a pandemic to make disinfectant. And 2 years ago, the Swiss moved to privatize the ethanol business, and maybe prematurely got rid of their 10,000 tons of alcohol. And now they're left with nothing.
Well, I mean, seriously, they've got their coffee. Do you think that we see a bit of a rewrite? I mean, so many things were sort of off the table. Let's cut here, let's cut there, even in luxurious Switzerland. Do you think in Bern that they start to relook at all of these things again out of all of this?
Well, I think generally compared to other countries, it's been going all right here. You're missing 10,000 tons of ethanol. They'll get it somewhere. Some wine cellar has been transferred into 3,000 liters of hand sanitizing gel. So I think they're going to be okay. But, obviously the general tendency by the Swiss to stockpile important raw materials. This certainly, I think, will continue after this and be even reinforced, maybe.
You have something from the Financial Times. Maybe we want to go there quickly. And it's really looking at, I guess, the performance of this country. Byrne, Federal Council, and obviously the central bank, obviously being in lockstep with the national bank brands.
Indeed. And I think even Swiss, who are sort of generally used to things working pretty smoothly, were surprised by how efficient the government's response has been in helping small businesses, and particularly how efficient they've been in paying out those loans. So, for example, one example in the FT story today is how you basically, you know, owner of a small business fills in a form. It literally takes a few minutes and gets the money into his account the same afternoon. They're quoting one example of a small business owner from Graubünden, Alberto Belolli, who has an engineering business, and he said he filled in a form on Friday afternoon, and the money was in the account on Monday, and it was a one-page form. Now, contrast that to stories you hear from other countries, France, you know, Germany, where, you know, obviously there's a lot of paperwork involved in it, and bureaucracy, and bankers not so keen to part with the money. Whereas in Switzerland, basically loans to small businesses, you know, take something like 20 minutes. I mean, basically, the story says you can apply for a loan of up to 10% of your annual revenue, and, you know, capped at half a million francs. You get it interest free and guaranteed by the government, and only takes a few. It takes a day, basically. Mm.
I can say someone who you know quite close to this business in this building applied yesterday morning, and probably 11 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the money was in the account.
I mean, amazing.
It really does happen. Jan Hinton from Bloomberg, we're going to have to leave it there. That's all for today's program. Thanks to our producers, Marcus Hippie in London, Carlotta Ribello, and Paige Reynolds, also a researcher, Charlie Fillmore Court, and our studio manager was David Stevens. Here in Zurich, a big thank you to Linda Husser. Also, after this, we're going to have the headlines at the top of the hour. The briefing is live at midday from London. The Globalist returns at the very same time tomorrow. For all of us here in Zurich, I'm Tyler Brulé. Have a very good day. Goodbye.